in the limelight.
The Zionist regime forces, including snipers, occupied the roof of the Al-Aqsa Mosque prayer hall and shattered windows so they could fire live and rubber-coated bullets and tear gas into the house of worship. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Zionist Regime Terrorizes Ramadan Worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque. Here's more. The Zionist regime occupation forces attacked Al-Aqsa Mosque, wounding more than 150 Palestinians while it was filled with Ramadan worshippers on one of the holiest days in the Islamic calendar. Six people sustained serious injuries during the hours-long assault on one of the world's most significant religious sites early Friday, April 15th, according to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, and more than 400 were arrested. The rights group said that the violence began after thousands of worshippers observed dawn prayers amid the heavy presence of the Zionist regime occupation forces in the area, including on the rooftops of gates to the mosque compound. After the dawn prayer, Palestinians placed wooden barriers around the Al-Aqsa Mosque prayer hall in anticipation of an Israeli raid, PCHR said, and fired firecrackers toward one of the gates where the Zionist regime forces were stationed. Immediately, Israeli occupation forces raided the entire mosque with hundreds of troops and fired live bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades, PCHR added. The Zionist regime forces closed off entry to the compound, preventing access to paramedics, and attacked mosque guards, health workers, and media personnel. Al Jazeera reported that one of the guards was shot in the eye with a rubber-coated bullet. PCHR said the Zionist regime forces, including snipers, occupied the roof of the Al-Aqsa Mosque prayer hall and shattered windows so they could fire live and rubber-coated bullets and tear gas into the house of worship. Video shows the upper stained glass windows of the mosque's prayer hall being broken from outside. The Zionist regime forces inside the mosque forced worshippers to lay down and arrested hundreds, PCHR added, before ordering those remaining to evacuate. Video shows worshippers lying on the ground with hands tied behind their backs. Children were also among those arrested. Worshippers were beaten by the Zionist regime forces while evacuating. Three paramedics were injured during the assault, including one who was struck by a rubber-coated bullet in the neck. Three journalists were injured, including photojournalist Rami Khatib, who was beaten by the Zionist regime forces wielding batons. The assault on Khatib was recorded on video. Khatib said that his arm as well as his camera were broken in the Zionist regime's attack. The Zionist regime's foreign ministry attempted to spin the police raid on Al-Aqsa as an effort to protect freedom of worship from violent rioters desecrating the site and endangering the public, though scores of videos show the opposite was the case. Francesca Albanese, the newly appointed UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip, stated on Friday, April 15th, that places of worship as an extension of freedom of religion must be protected, especially on holy days. She added that intentional attacks on civilian constitutes war crimes under the Rome Statute, founding the International Criminal Court. That body opened up an investigation into war crimes in the West Bank and Gaza Strip last year. Sheikh Ikrima Sabri, the Imam of Al-Aqsa, called the Zionist regime siege a premeditated and orchestrated attack that aimed to accommodate a raid on the holy site by Israeli extremists during the Passover holiday that began on Friday evening, April 15th. Earlier in the week, an extremist Israeli group that seeks the destruction of the mosque and its replacement with a Jewish temple offered a cash prize for any attempted animal sacrifices on the Al-Aqsa compound during the Passover. On Thursday, April 14th, the Zionist regime arrested six people on suspicion that they intended to perform such a ritual at the holy site. Following the siege on Al-Aqsa, the director of the mosque, Sheikh Omar al-Kiswani, called on worshippers to gather at the holy site to perform Friday prayers and defend it. Ismail Haniyeh, the head of Hamas political office, said on Friday, April 15th, that Palestinians and Muslims would defend and protect Al-Aqsa at any price. A similar Israeli regime assault on the holy site during the Ramadan last year also sparked a military confrontation. More than 250 Palestinians in Gaza, including at least 67 children, were killed during the 11 days of intense violence that followed. Palestinian armed groups, meanwhile, fired thousands of rockets from Gaza during the fighting, killing around a dozen people in the occupied territories. On Friday, April 15th, Palestinians in Gaza protested the Zionist regime's attack on Al-Aqsa earlier that day and deadly repression throughout the West Bank in recent weeks. Some called on Palestinian resistance factions to respond to the occupation violence. Palestinians in Gaza reportedly headed to shops to stock up on essentials in anticipation of a possible major Israeli regime attack on the besieged territory. The Zionist regime imposed a lockdown on Palestinian movement from the West Bank and Gaza Strip at the outset of Passover, as is typical during major Israeli holidays. Also on Friday, April 15th, a Palestinian child died from injuries sustained the previous day during an arrest raid in Kafardan village near the northern West Bank city of Jenin. Shaukat Kamal Shaukat Abed, 17, was shot in the stomach while Palestinian youth threw stones at Israeli regime troops withdrawing from the area. Suddenly and without warning, an Israeli troop pointed his gun out the rear window of the vast vehicle in the convoy and began indiscriminately shooting at protesters from a distance of approximately 25 meters, striking the teen and 29-year-old Shas Kemaji, who died from his injuries. Injuries suggest that Shaukat was struck with an exploding bullet that ruptured his blood vessels and veins. Defense for Children International Palestine stated. The rights group added the use of expanding and exploding bullets is a violation of international humanitarian law and amounts to a war crime under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. Shaukat is the eighth Palestinian child shot and killed by Israeli regime forces in 2022, and the third Palestinian child killed by Israeli regime forces this week, the CIP said. 18 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli regime forces in the West Bank and occupied territories since the beginning of April.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the spiritual level of fasting. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. Brothers and sisters, there are three levels of fasting as explained by some of the scholars and as classified by some of the scholars. The basic level, the moral level, and the spiritual level. We have talked about the basic level in the past, and we have also discussed the moral level, right? Which is the next step of the basic level. Now, what is the spiritual level is something that we would like to discuss today. Brothers and sisters, this is the level of the exceptional people, khasul khas, as it is said. This is the fasting of the heart in which one focuses only on Almighty Allah and refrains from focusing on mundane issues of this world. Those who elevate their fast to this level have been described by the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam as the guests of Allah, and those who have the honor, karama, of Allah. In his famous sermon, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "It is the month in which you have been invited to be guests of Allah, and you have been made in it the people who have the honor of Allah." Brothers and sisters, this is huge. This is for our Urafa. This is for those elite believers, those servants of Allah who really strive and struggle. So in addition to not carrying out those actions which invalidate one's fast, they also are very careful about their other limbs, their other parts of the body. And this third level, it takes them to a whole different world where they are so focused on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that they don't even think of something other than Allah. Now, this is definitely something very difficult to achieve, but remember, it's not impossible. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the spiritual levels of fasting, right? And we said that there are three different types or levels of the classification of fasting as explained by our Urafa and Ulama of Akhlaq. And today we would like to bring a few words of dua in this blessed month of Ramadan, which will, inshallah, result in our proximity and our closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. O Allah, bless Muhammad and his family. Inspire us with knowledge of its virtue, veneration of its sanctity, and protection from what you have forbidden within it. O Allah, help us to fast in it by restraining our limbs from disobeying you and by employing them in that which pleases you, so that we lend not our ears to idle talk and we don't let our eyes easily glance towards haram diversion, and so that we stretch not our hands towards the forbidden things and stride not with our feet towards the prohibited places, and so that our bellies hold only what you have made lawful, and our tongues speak only what you have exemplified, and so that we undertake nothing but what brings us close to your reward, and pursue nothing but what protects us from your punishment. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo Jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Racial tensions are running high in Grand Rapids, Michigan, after police this week released footage of a white officer lying on the back of an unarmed black man, shooting him in the head. Patrick Leoya, 26, was killed on April 4th after a struggle during a traffic stop. State police are investigating the incident. The officer is currently on administrative leave pending the outcome of the investigation. Authorities say he would not be identified unless criminal charges are pressed against him. The family of Leoya called the video of the shooting, quote, the most horrifying thing they've ever seen, and asked for the officer's name to be released. The shooting has led to protests in the area, with activists expressing grief and frustration with years of inaction on policing issues by Grand Rapids leaders.
Given the U.S.'s long history of police brutality, from Rodney King to George Floyd and now today, we can't be shocked. And I think that the black community should and is justified in being angry at the establishment and seeking methods outside of the establishment and the political structure for seeking change.
The fatal shooting of the unarmed black man by the white officer is the latest on a very long list of similar incidents. Police killings of black men have dominated national debates in recent years, particularly after the 2020 murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, which triggered persistent protests across America. The deep-rooted problem lingers on. So far this year, over 250 people have been fatally shot by on-duty police officers nationwide. The latest case is another bitter reminder that the system in the United States has failed to take measures to resolve the pressing problem. The April 4th shooting has once again brought deadly police violence in America under the spotlight. Civil rights organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, has been quick to react. The NAACP, which tries to advance justice for African Americans, said in a statement that the shooting is horrifying and deeply frustrating because Americans had meaningful legislation designed to avoid exactly what they are witnessing in this week's police video. It said the involved officer has blood on his hands, and so do the senators who killed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. The piece of legislation was passed by the U.S. House of Representatives in March 2021, but bipartisan negotiations in the U.S. Congress over the police reform bill ended in stalemate. The sweeping legislation was passed by the House amid outcry after the murder of George Floyd. It would have banned chokeholds and qualified immunity for law enforcement. It would have also created national standards for policing in an effort to increase accountability.
Lack of efforts to reform the system that are coming from the top. There's no real incentive for legislators to reform when they are benefiting off of the corrupt policing system and corrupt judicial system that this country has. There's also a lack of struggle in the organizations, a lack of structure in the organizations that are struggling against police brutality.
The failure to pass the police reform has been considered as a setback for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden, who had energetically supported the legislation. President Biden has faced growing calls to sign an executive order to reform the police, but has failed to act. Experts believe ethnic minorities in America, especially African Americans, are facing a very deep-rooted problem that will not be resolved anytime soon. Observers have largely attributed this to the racist roots of American policing and social structures.
Nearly 7 weeks have passed since the start of the war in Ukraine. Russia is now focusing on taking territory in the eastern regions of the country. Ukraine and Russia are building up their military forces in the eastern regions of Donetsk and Luhansk.
It's a very serious situation. The fact that the Russian forces are there have made significant moves, especially in the east of Ukraine and other parts, is unacceptable to the United States, and they're not prepared to negotiate. And I believe that their advice to Zelensky, talked into Biden today, to assured him of about, what was $130 million more worth of equipment, that they want them to continue fighting, to continue resisting, but they're not going to send any troops there.
Over the past weeks, Ukraine has enjoyed the support of Western powers, especially the United States. Western nations have sent different types of weapons to Ukraine worth millions of dollars. The U.S. is to announce $750 million in new military aid for Ukraine. The new military aid package would likely include military equipment such as unmanned surface vehicles, Mi-17 helicopters, howitzers, and protective equipment against possible chemical attacks. The Pentagon has hosted leaders from the top eight U.S. weapons manufacturers to discuss the industry's capacity to help arm Ukraine, even if Russia's invasion lasts as long as 2 years.
So there will be a lot more people dying because the United States is insistent, I think, that Putin's forces have to be forced out of Ukraine before this is all over. And it's not going to be happening anytime soon.
Resupplying as well as planning for a longer war were expected to be discussed at the meeting. The Pentagon has said smaller systems such as Javelin anti-tank missiles and Stinger anti-aircraft missiles have proved to be the most useful weapons. Washington and its Western allies have been shipping these weapons to Ukraine on a nearly daily basis. A partnership between Lockheed Martin and Raytheon Technologies makes the anti-tank Javelin. Raytheon manufactures the Stinger, which shoots down aircraft. Ukraine is ramping up its campaign for military aid even as the U.S. accelerates shipments of weapons to Kiev. Arms lobbyists and their underlings in Congress and the Pentagon are scrambling now to unlock more funds for the military-industrial complex to pump out weapons to Europe.
Unless there are other parties within the world community and also even within NATO to resist this type of policy, It's going to be a very long and costly war. And the cost is going to be borne by the world community, which will suffer in increasing food prices, increasing energy, increasing starvation for millions of people.
But amid the unanimous support for Ukraine, there are critical voices that have been raised against supplying weapons to Ukraine. It's argued that the money channeled to the military industry is used to fuel more bloodshed in Ukraine. Hawks in the West lobby recklessly for NATO to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine.
They believe that a world empire effectively can be created, in which the United States is the fundamental maker of the rules. Now, every attempt to create an empire in the world has ended up in either failure or disaster. They haven't learned those lessons.
That could be a direct military confrontation between Russia and Ukraine. It's also feared that a nuclear war is also becoming a possibility. A recent poll has shown that the U.S. is being drawn into an all-out war with Russia.
A new report released by Iran's Nur News website on Monday says undercover Israeli military personnel deployed to U.S. bases in the region are conducting their own missions independent of American forces present in those bases. The report says the important point about regional presence is the deployment of undercover military and intelligence agents of Israel in some regional countries that enjoy close relations with Iran. Experts believe that the main goal behind the presence of the Israeli agents in some regional countries is to spy on and collect direct information related to Iran's important bases and sensitive facilities.
It's a very dangerous precedent. What we now know is that the IDF and Zionist regime's different intelligence units like Mossad are working within Central Command, are working alongside U.S. Forces, NATO forces, and their allies, the Gulf states in the region. And they are their main focus is to control what's going on in the region and ultimately to fight against Iran. And this is a dangerous escalation. And we've seen it now over the past few years, first with the United States removal from the JCPOA, the brutal assassination of General Soleimani, and the increasing hawkish nature of U.S. foreign policy.
The report notes that although the Iranian armed forces are closely monitoring these provocative moves, for which the host countries are also responsible, the nature of these actions will increase tension and instability in the region and can lead to unpredictable conditions. It added that high-resolution documented photos are available on the presence of Israeli regime's aircraft and espionage equipment in the U.S. bases in some regional countries, which confirmed the intelligence gathered in the field on Israel's anti-Iran activities in the region. According to the new report, senior officials of countries where Israeli undercover experts have been present have been aware of the Israeli military and intelligence presence in their countries, but prefer to keep silent. The project started when Israel was transferred from the United States European Command, EUCOM, to U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, in order to enable the Tel Aviv regime to carry out its intelligence and military conspiracies in West Asia following the withdrawal of the United States from the region. While some believe the normalization of ties between some Arab states and Israel has laid the groundwork for and provided Tel Aviv with a pretext to conduct its operations close to Iranian borders, others say the U.S. is assigning tasks to Israel to carry out in its stead in the region.
Their main focus is on Iran, and they are having in the region allies like Arab Gulf states and others who are focused on this. And secondly, it's to help the United States, who sees China as a threat because China and Iran's close ties and now their alliance is a threat to U.S. Zionist stability and their control in the region. So I think that what we see here is the move to Central Command is primarily against Iran, but also undergirding that from the United States is Iran's relationship with China.
Iran has shown that it won't stand idly by in the face of foreign aggression. The January 2020 attack on the Ain al-Assad air base in Iraq housing U.S. troops is one example. Iran carried out the retaliatory missile attack in the aftermath of the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and Iraq's deputy commander of the Popular Mobilization Unit, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in Baghdad. Iranian officials have, on so many occasions, noted that the Islamic Republic won't tolerate the presence of Israel in the region, highlighting the threats that the Israeli regime poses to the regional nations. Will they heed the warnings? Only time can tell.
Al-Hawl camp is located 15 kilometers away from the Syrian-Iraqi border. It is the largest camp of Daesh elements and is controlled by the U.S.-affiliated Syrian Democratic Forces. The militants are holding tens of thousands of people in Al-Hawl camp, East Hasaka City. They run it in cooperation with U.S. occupation forces, including thousands of Daesh terrorists of different nationalities and their families, whom Washington invests and employs to implement its plans in the region. Meanwhile, Iraq's National Security Advisor, Qasem al-Araji, has expressed concern about the possibility of the release of Daesh elements and leaders from prisons controlled by U.S.-backed Kurdish militants in eastern Syria. He says Daesh has made numerous attempts to break such prisons since most of the terrorist group's leaders are incarcerated there. He has frequently met with U.S. officials and United Nations envoys to stress the need to resolve the issue of the Al-Hawl refugee camp in the northeastern Syrian province of Hasaka. The senior Iraqi official called on foreign governments to repatriate their citizens from Al-Hawl and urged a rapid dismantlement of the camp. Daesh began a terror campaign in Iraq in 2014, overrunning vast swathes in lightning attacks. Iraq declared victory over Daesh in December 2017 after a three-year counter-terrorism military campaign, which also had the support of neighboring Iran. The remnants, though, keep staging sporadic attacks across Iraq, attempting to regroup and unleash fresh violence. Daesh has intensified its terrorist attacks in Iraq since January 2020, when the United States assassinated top Iranian anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and deputy commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, near Baghdad International Airport. The Iraqi anti-terror resistance groups have repeatedly warned Baghdad that the remnants of Daesh active in Syria's U.S.-occupied east may find unhindered access to the Iraqi border and infiltrate into its western Anbar province. This is while the positions of the PMU and its affiliated resistance groups operating against Daesh in the border regions have repeatedly come under attack by the U.S. military over the past years.
The United States funnels money into these groups, into these very kind of ethno-nationalist and separatist organizations that are against the current government of, in this case, Syria. And of course, the government of Syria happens to be very anti-U.S., so naturally, the United States is going to fund groups that want to topple the government of a given country that opposes NATO, that opposes to the West, that opposes U.S. dominance.
The U.S. military has stationed forces and military equipment in eastern and northeastern Syria, with the Pentagon claiming that the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. Damascus, however, says the unlawful deployment is meant to plunder the country's resources. Former U.S. President Donald Trump admitted on several occasions that American forces were in Syria for its oil. Additionally, security conditions have been deteriorating in the areas under the control of U.S.-backed Kurdish militants in Syria's northern and northeastern provinces of Raqqa, Hasaka, and Deir ez-Zor.
The Assads, Hafez and Bashar al-Assad, who have been the last two presidents of Syria, have not allowed the United States or the corporations of the West to come into the country and buy up the oil companies and began allowing Shell and British Petroleum and the other
major oil monopolies to come into Syria and to steal the natural resources that rightly belong to the Syrian nation, to the Syrian government and their people. And so as a result, the United States has decided, with the backing of NATO and Western European powers, that the only option at this point is either a full invasion of Syria to topple the Assad government, which would be absolutely disastrous and have horrible repercussions for the United States and the West on a geopolitical scale.
Local Syrians complain that U.S.-backed militants' constant raids have generated a state of frustration and instability, severely affecting their businesses and livelihood. Residents accuse the U.S.-sponsored militants of stealing crude oil. Local council affiliated with the militants also stand accused of financial corruption.
In the limelight.
Hundreds of people have held protests after police in Grand Rapids, Michigan, released three videos of a white police officer shooting a black man dead. Patrick Loyal, 26, was fatally shot on April 4th in what activists refer to as the latest example of police violence against young black men. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Nina Lakhani titled, "That Was My Beloved Son." Family of Patrick Loya say police killed their son in an execution. Please stay with us to hear more about the details. The grief-stricken parents of the black man shot in the back of the head by a white Michigan police officer have described their son's death as an execution. Patrick Loya, 26-year-old Congolese refugee, was killed after a traffic stop in Grand Rapids on April 4th. His father, Peter Loya, on Thursday, April 14th, through an interpreter, said, "I didn't believe that there is a genocide in this country," adding, "I didn't know that here in America, there can be execution style to be killed by the police officer." The Loya family came to the U.S. fleeing violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2014. Patrick, a factory worker, was the eldest of six children and had two young daughters. Video footage released by the Grand Rapids police chief on Wednesday, April 13th, shows a short foot chase on a residential street after Loya ran from the officer who stopped him for driving with a license plate that didn't belong to the vehicle. They are shown briefly struggling over the officer's taser before he apparently shoots Loya in the back of the head while kneeling on his back. Peter Loya said, "It made me cry to see my son killed by a police officer for a small mistake," adding, "My heart was really broken. My life was Patrick, my son. I was thinking Patrick will take my place, and to see that my son was killed like an animal by this U.S. police officer." Lawyers for the family said the officer should be prosecuted, fired, and named. Peter said Patrick's brothers and sisters want to know who killed him and would like to see his picture so they can know this is the person that took our beloved one. The officer has been placed on paid leave with his police powers suspended while Michigan State Police conduct a criminal investigation. Police bosses have said he will not be identified publicly unless there are criminal charges. A rally took place in Grand Rapids on Friday, April 15th, as protests supporting the family's call for justice have grown since the video footage was released. But prosecutor Chris Becker, who will decide whether any charges are brought against the 7-year veteran officer and had objected to the footage being released, said not to expect a quick decision. Grand Rapids is a small city of about 200,000 people located about 150 miles northwest of Detroit, where, like many places in the U.S., the police have faced criticism over the use of excessive force, particularly against black people, who made up 18% of the population. At the news conference inside Renaissance Church of God in Christ in Grand Rapids on Thursday, April 14th, Loyal's parents explained that they sought asylum in the U.S. looking for safety after years of civil unrest and violence at home in eastern Congo. His mother, Dorcas Loyal, told the Free Press through translator, "They told us that in America there is peace, there is safety, you're not going to see killing anymore, that it was basically a safe haven," adding, "What is so surprising? The man supposed to be protecting us is the one who shot my son," she said. "That was my beloved son. You know how my love, your firstborn son." The family were accompanied by their attorneys and the mother of Breonna Taylor, a black woman, a native of Grand Rapids, shot dead inside her home by police in Louisville, Kentucky in 2020. Ben Crump, a prominent civil rights lawyer who has represented several victims of police violence, as Patrick's parents wept, said, "The video shows us that this is, as his mother and father have said, an execution, and there is no way to spin it or justify," adding, "It is an unjustifiable use of deadly force because the police escalated a traffic stop into an execution." Crump said the officer could have waited for backup when Loyal ran out, but instead got violent. He accused the unidentified officer of breaking protocol by using taser while close to Loyal, adding that it was natural instinct for Loyal to try to avoid being stunned. Crom said there was no reason for the officer to have any intimate fear of the taser being used against him. The Loyal family first escaped from DRC to Malawi, where they were granted asylum to live in the U.S. In recent years, Congolese people have become the largest group settled in Michigan, overtaking refugees from West Asia after Donald Trump made it virtually impossible for Arab and Muslim people to gain asylum in the U.S. The family lawyers pointed to the language barriers Congolese and others face when dealing with police. Crump said, "We were condemning Takfiri terrorists for shooting civilians in Iraq and Syria in the back of the head," adding, "Why aren't we condemning police officers here in the United States of America shooting black civilians in the back of the head? If it was wrong in Iraq and Syria, it's wrong in Grand Rapids, Michigan." Dorcas described her eldest son as the type of person you would want to be around and said he would often make her laugh. "Details of the funeral are expected soon," Dorcas said. "As a parent, I was thinking that maybe it was my son who was going to bury me, assist me at my funeral," adding, "But it is astonishing. I am the one burying my son." Hundreds of people have held protests after police in Grand Rapids, Michigan, released three videos of the white police officer shooting the black man dead. The three videos were taken from the dashboard of the officer's squad car, from his body-worn camera, and from a neighbor's surveillance camera. After the videos were released on Wednesday, April 13th, demonstrators marched through the city's downtown carrying Black Lives Matter placards and chanted, "No justice, no peace." Brian Foster, a black man who attended demonstrations, said, "I don't think the establishment are ever gonna listen to us," adding, "It's in their best interest not to. It's in their best interest to keep this war against my people going forever." Meanwhile, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, issued a written statement saying, Another black man has died at the hands of police, and the officer in this video has got to be held accountable. The NAACP said President Biden signed the police reform executive order now. While we fully understand an executive order is not a substitute for meaningful legislation, we must do everything in our power to protect our community. Massive protests have been held across the country following the killings of African-American men, George Floyd and Daunte Wright, by white police officers in 2020. Floyd's death in May 2020 sparked angry protests across the U.S. and across the world. The protests evolved into a nationwide battle between progressives and far-right groups after former President Donald Trump took a hardline stance against the anti-racism protest.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Environmental protection is one of the most fundamental and essential tasks in the country. March 6th, 2022. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure progeny. And may God curse all their enemies. First of all, I'd like to congratulate the entire Iranian nation and all those who hear these statements on the birth anniversary of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, peace be upon him. The holy existence of Hussein ibn Ali, peace be upon him, is the center of love for the Iranian nation and all Muslim nations, including Shias and non-Shias. I hope that this day will be a blessed day for the Iranian nation, and that the Holy Prophet of Islam, the Commander of the Faithful, and Siddiqat al-Tahira, greetings be upon them, will give a gift to the Iranian nation and all Muslim nations today. Well, today is tree planting day. Thankfully, I planted 2 saplings like previous years, and I did what I could do in this regard. All our dear brothers and sisters should know that planting trees is a religious and revolutionary move. It is an action that originates in religion and the revolution.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Today, everyone who is active in this regard should know that they are doing a revolutionary and religious task. Of course, planting is the first step and preservation is the next one. In other words, preserving trees is also very important and it should receive due attention. God the Exalted has made plants the source of life for all people. Plants are a source of food, medicine, breathing, and natural beauty. They are interesting to watch, soothe the heart and soul, and protect the human body. Plants are like this. Therefore, planting and preserving plants is a public duty for all humans, because humans are dependent on them. That is why I stress, as I have always done so, that the destruction of forests, the natural environment, vegetation and trees is the destruction and jeopardization of national interest. Everyone should know that if they destroy part of a forest in order to put up building, this is surely to the disadvantage of national interest. Of course, this could be done in certain emergency cases, but generally speaking, this is undoubtedly to the disadvantage of the nation and of national interest.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
People in the besieged Gaza Strip held a rally following the Friday prayers to express their solidarity with Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Angry protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowing to sacrifice their lives for the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Earlier, the Israeli regime forces stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds, injuring more than 150 worshippers during the second Friday of the fasting holy month of Ramadan. Hamas movement has warned the Israeli regime against violations at Al-Aqsa Mosque.
We are prepared to wage wars for the sake of Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will continue to the equation of arms for arms and blood for blood, and that Al-Quds is a red line that must not be crossed. The Israeli occupation will bear full responsibility for any repercussions as a result of its attacks against the worshippers. We are ready for all scenarios to stop this enemy and protect our people.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vow to increase their solidarity with Al-Quds until the removal of all Israeli violations in the holy city.
The Palestinian people are united for the sake of Al-Quds, and we will not abandon Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will fight for the sake of Al-Quds and sacrifice our lives for it.
The Israeli regime has stepped up its deadly acts of aggression in Al-Quds since the beginning of Ramadan. Palestinian resistance factions warned the Israeli regime of dire consequences if Israeli forces continue to attack Al-Quds.
The Israeli is sending a clear message to the Zionist enemy that it must understand that we will not sit idle while it attacks Al-Quds. The Zionist enemy is playing with fire, and it will only explode in its face.
The Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967.
Palestinians in the besieged coastal enclave say that they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The latest second-round polls in France continue to show that Emmanuel Macron's once comfortable lead has vanished to make the race a dead heat. The mainstream media's insistence on talking about Islamophobia and xenophobia has already produced near-record abstention, but the unrest in Ukraine has forced real issues back to the fore. First the Great Recession, then the Age of Austerity, then the Yellow Vest Civil War, then the coronavirus era, and now an era of Russian sanctions? Devoted Europhile Macron remains committed to a long-term blockade of Russia, which requires years of economic suffering for the average household. Analysts say that voters may prefer Le Pen's France First insistence that any Russia sanctions not bankrupt French homes and businesses.
She is she's a nationalist, and she's protectionist in some way. She's also protective. She has understood that it was important to sound as someone that would be here to take care of electors. It's whether it's for good or bad, but a lot of French people want to feel that they have a protective hand in government.
Le Pen has also promised to pull out of NATO's command center to restore French independence. Macron is relying on a demonization campaign of the National Front, just like in 2017. When the number two reason people voted for Macron was to block them from coming to power.
He is, in a way, a president by default. The number one paradox of this campaign is that, indeed, we've had 5 years of a president who's managed to be disliked by almost everybody and who yet is favored to be reelected.
Back when he thought victory was assured, Macron promised to raise the retirement age to 65 this fall. That may cost him key older and left-wing votes. He's backtracking and saying that he's now willing to listen to the ideas and desires of voters. Do left-wing voters believe Macron's claims that he's now willing to govern by consensus? Does France view Le Pen differently after 5 years of Macronism? The winning candidate may be the one who proves that they have changed the most since the very different year of 2017. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Arms trafficking at Italy's main sea dispatch points is ongoing in breach of international and Italian laws. Dockers have found U.S.-made tanks in the hold of a Saudi ship docked at the port of Genoa. Our correspondent Max Civili has this report from Rome.
Italian ports have often been central to international arms trafficking over the past years. Cargos of weapons destined for war-torn countries have been intercepted in various seaports, including those of Livorno, Naples, and Gioia Tauro. On Wednesday, dockers belonging to the autonomous port workers collective CALP found tanks in the hold of the Saudi Arabian ship Bahri Jeddah, which is moored in the Italy's northern port of Genoa. CALP dockers have taken photos of the weapons placed on board the ship and published them on the collective's website.
The ship carries weapons and ammunition. We spotted M1 Abrams tanks already armed, produced in the US. On the deck of the ship, there are also containers full of ammunition and explosives in plain sight. It is extremely dangerous and against international and Italian laws.
About 10 days ago, CALP dockers, together with rights associations and pacifist movements, staged a protest demanding the port authority more transparency on ships' cargoes transiting in Genoa. Dockers have said the demands have not yet been addressed.
These ships carrying cargo of arms and explosives are not just operating in breach of international and Italian laws. Cargo of this sort is extremely dangerous for the dockers and for thousands of people living in the surroundings of the port of Genoa. In addition to that, ships are moored near a chemical warehouse and an oil depot. You can imagine the safety implications of that.
The Weapon Watch Observatory has also found that the number of Italian aircraft carriers that are transporting weapons towards Poland has dramatically increased over the past weeks. Rome has been sending tons of arms and humanitarian aid to Ukraine since the start of the conflict there. The arms industry in Italy is prospering. 10 years ago, Rome was the 10th largest weapons producer in the world. Today it stands as the 6th. Furthermore, following the start of the conflict in Ukraine, the Mario Draghi government has